sponsors.
And welcome back to Backbone Radio. You're listening to Krista Kafer on 710 KNUS or 1460 AM KZNT in Colorado Springs. Having a terrific night. Our next guest, I introduced him a bit on the last segment, but I just want to kind of recap who he is. He is with the Heritage Foundation's Center for Policy Innovation, one of the smartest men probably in the world, and certainly one of the smartest men I've ever known, and a person that I had the amazing privilege to work with back at my Heritage days. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stuart Butler.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and I must say I should let my daughters hear your kind introduction because they don't have quite the same opinion of me.
Well, they should, but when you're young, you don't know how awesome your parents are until I think about mid-20s is when it started to happen for me.
That's about right.
Then you're like, wow, they're so smart.
well, welcome. Not as stupid as I thought.
Yeah, you think you're smarter than your parents till you hit about 25, and then you're hanging on every last word they speak after that. But, well, welcome to the show. I feel like it's been forever since we spoke.
That's my pleasure.
When I was there, I was talking in the last segment about how you were in charge of a different department at the Heritage Foundation, and now you're with the Center for Policy Innovation, looking for unique answers to challenging problems our nation is facing. And this means that you travel quite a bit, because I know you were out here at Health One in Denver, looking at some of the things
Denver
they're
Health,
doing.
Yes.
Denver Health, yes. Well,
yes.
I was just out of curiosity, what did you see there that you liked?
Well, Denver Health is one of probably a handful of health organizations around the country that really are seen as trying some very innovative approaches to dealing with the whole system. And, for example, one of the things that particularly struck me at Denver Health is that they have a 24-hour call-in system where if you've got a medical problem of any kind, and you're part of their system, you call in, you get straight through to a skilled nurse who then, if your child's got a fever or something like that, and it's the middle of the night, they will talk this through with you. They will draw in a doctor if necessary. They will send a prescription directly to a pharmacy right next to you and so on. So, for example, because of that, you don't have to wait till the next morning. You don't have to go to the emergency room. And so on, things like that, which are not high tech exactly, but can make a huge difference to the way medicine actually is practiced and the actual results, as the kind of thing that you see in places like Denver Health or Geisinger in Pennsylvania and a number of other health systems around the country.
Well, I think it would cut down. I know that much of the expense in Medicaid and Medicare and other state programs, that one of the expenses is that people a certain population of people go to the hospital regardless of what problem they have, a toothache, a headache, a broken leg, it doesn't matter. And that rather than getting preventative care, rather than seeing doctors for smaller injuries, they go straight to the hospital. I would think this call-in program would help curtail some of that and help people to manage their health care in such a way that if they did have a serious problem, they would go to the emergency room. Otherwise, they might be able to go a different route.
Well, that's exactly right. And, one of the problems that one sees immediately when you see these kinds of innovations is that very often the way that we pay for healthcare or the regulations associated with healthcare don't in fact give an incentive for that kind of service. So I see Denver Health, for example, points out that when it runs a system like this, it's very hard to get the kind of payment that you need from Medicaid, say, to run a program like that, even though it reduces the total cost of Medicaid in that area. It's actually better for someone like Denver Health if the person does show up at the emergency room and runs up a big bill that can be then sent to the state and the federal government. It's the same with physicians who will respond to you by email, for example. Over the weekend, you may have a problem. If you would get your doctor to be in touch with you by email, it would then make it unnecessary to get an office visit, on the Monday morning or something like that. That cost would go down. But very often the physician is not reimbursed for that kind of service. So one of the things you've got to do is to align the incentives and the payment system to actually reward innovation of that kind. And that's one of the problems we face in this country.
So one of the things that the Senate then would do is they would find these innovations and then be able to work with Congress to find ways to address them, or work with regulatory bodies to be able to provide some space for innovation, I would think.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you've got, I guess, sort of two levels of issue here. You know, one is what I've been talking about, which are sort of on-the-ground innovations, so to speak, you know, things that are happening every day, and you want to have policies that encourage that. But then I think at a larger sort of 50,000-foot level, you've got the general question of how do you, in general, encourage innovation and particularly efficiency-improving, cost-cutting innovation in areas like healthcare or higher education or these sorts of areas. And there I think you've really got two schools of thought. One is the what you might call the search for the sort of magic bullet approach, which is you often see government doing, which is sort of looking around for what seems to be effective, and then let's try to make everybody do the same thing as that. It's sort of the search for this sort of the wonder cure. The other approach is to say, let's set up conditions and environment that actually encourages all kinds of innovations or experimentation to occur, so that a market, so to speak, gradually rewards the ones that are most effective. And I think, as you can probably imagine, that the second is the more most likely to give us the kinds of breakthroughs that we need in all sorts of areas of our economy and in public activity.
What are a few kind of highlights of things you've seen in the last year that you, regardless of sort of sector, whether it be healthcare, education, et cetera, what have you seen that's really struck you as quite fantastic?
Well, I think actually the thing that is, I find most exciting right now is what's happening in higher education, or at least what I think is about to happen in higher education.
Really? Not exactly the easiest to change.
Well, it isn't easy to change if you try to do it by persuading people who run the current sort of system to change the ways that they do things. But what's actually happening is you're finding, particularly driven by online education, some really radical changes are happening and some different organization of higher education happening. Western Governors University, for example, which is based in the western states, provides higher education that's based on credentialing specific courses rather than a whole university, and allows the professors, actually they're really course managers, to put together a variety of packages of learning to obtain the level in those particular courses. And it's a very different way of looking at designing a higher education than we currently have. And I think particularly online education, which is really moving forward at a remarkable pace. And I don't just mean the for-profit sector that we're familiar with, but a lot of really startling things are going on. I really think that we could see a massive transformation in higher education within the next 10 years.
I would like to see that. I'm thinking about going back to school myself and have looked at a number of online programs. One of the things that does concern me, though, is the issue of quality.
Yes, no, you're exactly right. you know, these are the kinds of challenges then that you have to address. But, you know, when you hear about things like, just a couple of weeks ago, two world-renowned professors of artificial intelligence at Stanford University decided to quit their tenured positions and set up their own company to provide online courses in that and those sorts of areas.
Wow.
You know, that's just something that's beginning to happen. And they're talking about having 500,000 enrollees in their class. They already are doing it through Stanford itself, and they have 190,000 people enrolled in their classes.
That's amazing.
And it's just astounding. You just have to think completely differently about higher education. And then, of course, quality control becomes important. And that's why then when you look at things like how do you measure quality in education, as you well know, Christopher, I mean, it's a tough thing to do.
It is tough.
But you know, you have to look at indicators of quality, things like, you know, how much do people earn in their first job after they graduate, you know, things like that. What is the content? And have to have information systems that allow people to be able to choose intelligently between different universities or course structures and so on. And that's a whole other part of what's needed to have a transformation of a sector like higher education.
One of the things that concerns me is that with students being fairly insulated from cost because of all these loans and grants and such, I don't think that particularly maybe folks that have not come from a family with a higher education background or or don't know exactly what to look for may see a degree, an online degree or even regular degree, and think, oh, that's right for me, without really understanding what that quality is. You know, we've got the music coming on, which means this segment's about over. I'd like to hold you over the station break and hit the subject on the other side.
Sure, I'll do that.
Okay, well, we'll hear again from Dr. Stuart Butler momentarily. And welcome back to Backbone Radio with Krista Kafer. If you're noticing any themes in this bumper music, it is all about freedom. We are talking right now with Dr. Stuart Butler of the Center for Policy Innovation at the highly regarded, in fact, most influential Heritage Foundation, the greatest think tank in the world. And I should tell folks that if they want to check out Heritage, as I assume most of you routinely do, but for those who have not yet done so, go to www.heritage.org, and you will find the work of geniuses, including that of Dr. Stuart Butler. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We were talking before the break about one of my concerns is when students are insulated from the cost of education, they might enroll in a program thinking it's high quality, maybe they've been kind of sold a bill of goods, and then they end up on the hook and in debt to that school. And of course, as a taxpayer, I sort of don't want my money going to some of that kind of stuff. How do you, with online education or some of these newer for-profit colleges, what's the answer to that without stifling that segment?
Well, you know, it's a problem right now anyway. No matter what kind of system we're talking about, because the cost of education is a major purchase, whatever you do, and it's very easy to be suckered into doing the wrong thing. And very often, of course, today, people will go to a college and they will get into debt, and they'll discover that rather than graduate in 4 years, they graduate in 6 years, and it's costing them a lot more, and they're kind of stuck with it. So it's not a new problem. I think the right solution to that is really to improve, as we are doing, the quality of information with regard to comparing colleges. You know, if you think about how we take airplanes today compared with what we did maybe 25 years ago, people have a lot of more effective information through Expedia and through other things as to what's a good airline, what's an airline doesn't tend to get you there so on time, and that kind of thing. And I think that what we're beginning to see is the steady improvement of that kind of information with regard to colleges and courses. And I think that's part of what has to happen, particularly when you get new forms of education, innovations coming in. It is very hard to know what's for real and what's just a ripoff and so on. So, you know, that has to go hand in hand, and I think that's very, very important. In fact, we're doing a lot of research on how do you actually measure quality in higher education? Because that is critical to any big change like this.
And that, I imagine that's fairly tough. I mean, you do have the, you know, what kinds of jobs do graduates get after course completion and those kinds of things. But I imagine these are all sort of proxies. It's a bit
that's
difficult.
Correct. Yeah. No, it is difficult. You can only do it to some degree. And your point earlier about if it appears to be free or if it's subsidized debt, that does tend to make people less prone to look carefully at costs. It is one of the kind of ironies that people seem to be very willing to take on huge debt, but if they were spending even a fraction of that same amount of money by writing a check, they'd be much more careful about which choices they make. We see this all the time, and it's true in healthcare. It's even true in buying houses, of course. So I think part of the long-term strategy has to be to have a bigger proportion of most people's higher education paid for by saved money rather than indebtedness in the future. So We're looking at tax policies and other, you know, methods of encouraging people to save more for higher education rather than to see debt as the, you know, as the primary way in which they pay for it.
So we've seen some innovations in healthcare, innovations in higher education. What are some other areas that you're exploring?
Well, we're looking at generally the, one of the things that fits everything together is the whole idea of opportunity and economic mobility. We're sort of looking at the at all the things that really enable people to move up the economic ladder effectively. And so it's areas like building capital, tax policy, and so on, higher education, healthcare, but also institutions in communities, such as you look at some of the enormous successes we see in some parts of the country of enabling lower-income people, for example, to do very well. The Harlem Children's Zone, for instance, in Harlem, New York, has had a really remarkable track record at enabling people who come from very poor backgrounds to actually do very well in that community. And that's looking at social institutions and social organizations as well as other kinds of innovations. So it's a big area to look at in terms of thinking about these issues that will enable people to do better with their lives.
One of the hallmark of American civilization, and something I haven't seen anywhere else that I've traveled, is that it is just unheard of social mobility. I think about my two of my grandparents did not graduate from high school. Two of my grandparents worked for factories. The other two were in were sharecroppers, and then eventually worked in factories as well. And then now I'm a college graduate. It's phenomenal. I worry, though, that future generations, particularly as we go the more statist route, that you will not see that kind of social mobility, and we will end up like Europe, where you know you do what your parents did. You vacation where they vacationed. You live where they lived. There's no sense of being able to break out and do something different or better.
There's a growing concern that we are beginning to see more of that kind of pattern in this country, particularly for people at the lower end of the income level. We certainly know and have known for many decades of that people who are in really very impoverished areas of the United States do find it much harder than maybe in the past to move up. But I think that's becoming more of a pattern, particularly as we see, you know, really, quite frankly, the collapse of our K through 12 public education in this country, the enormous increase in costs of going to college. If you don't get a college degree in America today, it's very difficult to really do reasonably well in life. That didn't used to be the case, but it's very much the case now. And then when you look at somewhere like California, where in the public system, well, tuition went up, I think, 21% last year,
Oy.
And it's due to go up double-digit, you know, for the next several years. That's raising the bar so high financially that many people in that state and other states are just not going to be able to afford to go to college. And that's why these innovations that we were talking about earlier that could bring the cost down dramatically will be such provide such an opportunity to people who right now are beginning to fear that they can't achieve the American dream.
Well, it's interesting because I look at the computer that's sitting in front of me is vastly cheaper than computers were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. The, you know, whether it's a microwave, any kind of television equipment, everything, a lot of things seem to be going down in price per unit, but education, particularly higher ed, but also true for K-12,
right,
seems to be going up with a kind of questionable increases in quality or productivity. And
well, I think you know the answer why, because if you look at that computer and you think about what's happened in the last 20, 30 years, it's not that the original producers of computer systems, which have been around for many decades, sort of saw the light. It was because of people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, who basically came in with a completely different view of how to provide computing power to ordinary people.
So it's that groundbreaking innovation matters.
That's exactly right. And you've got to have a system, a society, and regulations that allow that to happen. And if you shut them out, then you will get Europe.
Well, I hope we're able to have you on the program again. This has been terrific. We're hitting the end of this section, but we will talk to you again in the future. Thank you so much, Dr. Butler.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.